This podcast is a London Business School lecture on the art of negotiation with Madan Pilutla, Professor of Organisational Behaviour. His research focuses on incentives, decision-making, negotiating and bargaining, and trust and fairness in interpersonal interactions. In it, Professor Pilutla covers new ideas in social psychology, the nudge process, and behavioural economics.
When you come to the London Business School, almost anything that we attempt to teach here, we will try to put it down within the context of a science. Okay, so it has to be, in some sense, it has to be empirically validated. It has to be ideas that have met some kind of a test out there in books, in journals, and so on, where peers review it and they say this kind of seems sensible, and here is the logic and here is the evidence that suggests that this is sensible. Okay, so when we called it the art of negotiation, I actually should have just said it's the arty part of the science of negotiation. So that seemed too much of a mouthful for us to do, so we just called it art, and that's what dragged a lot of you in. I'm sure if we had called it the science, we'd have had like three people here. So that's part of a marketing effort to try and get you into to do this. Here are a few ideas that I want to throw out. Okay, so these are ideas that have existed in psychology for some time. Some of these ideas, some of them are fairly new, but this is a mixture of the classic and the new ideas that are there in psychology, particularly in a kind of psychology which is called social psychology. You don't need to worry about what the different disciplines within psychology are. But it's these are ideas that have been prevalent that are new in these in this field. And probably underlies a lot of what we look at and today, and we call nudge. So how do I get people towards making the kind of decisions that I want them to be making? Okay, so it also goes by the name behavioral economics. What are these ideas? How are these ideas going to help us? Is what I'm going to be talking about. Okay, let's go with the first one. Okay, so the first idea that I want to talk about is this notion of commitment and consistency. So to do this, I just want to start with an example. This is a classic idea. Okay, so this is an idea. This is a social psychology study from the 1960s. Okay, so the idea itself, the experiment itself goes something like this. People were interested in the concept of commitment and consistency, which I'll come to in a minute. They wanted to study it in a particular fashion. And they said, okay, let's examine it in this fashion. Let's think about a request that most people will say no to. And let's figure a way out to get most people to say yes to that request. Okay, so that's what it is. So you can think about it as a really difficult negotiation. I'm trying to get someone to accept my point of view. I know that they are mostly likely to be resistant to that, and they are going to be resisting asking to do what I'm asking them to do. So how do I go about this? Okay, so this is what the idea was. So the psychologists who designed this, they went around, they knocked on the door of some very nice houses in Northern California, and with very nice yards, front yards, very nice front yards. They knocked on the door and they told them a story. They said they're part of a campaign to reduce accidents on account of careless driving and so on. And they wanted to raise awareness on this issue. So would people be interested in helping them do this? And the way they want them to help them do this is to say, would you please display this sign? And they showed them the sign, but the journal article did not have pictures. They described it. They said it was a really terribly designed sign in garish colors, poor lettering, everything awful about it. And showed this sign to people who are living in really nice homes, nice gardens, and so on, and said, to help us, would you mind displaying this big sign in your front yard? So to make it clear to people that you want to raise awareness. Most people, while sympathetic to the notion that they had to raise awareness about driving carefully and so on, most people said no. Okay, so less than 17% of the people said I would do this. That's the base thing. So as you can see, these are polite Californians who are turning down a request for something that they're kind of inclined to support it. Okay, so that was the kind of an issue. So then what did they do? They went to the second one here, another group of people with equally nice homes. Okay, see, these are not that thing, equally nice homes. What they did is that they first began with a very small request, the same old story, but a small request. Would you mind displaying a little sticker in your front window, in the car, and so on. You know, so would you mind doing something like this? And most people say yes, because it's a very, very easy request for you to fulfill. So most people said yes. A week after they had said yes, they got a knock on the door by the very same people who had given them that sticker and now told, you know, thank you so much for being part of the Drive Safely campaign. Would you mind displaying this big ugly sign? I mean, they didn't say big ugly, but would you mind displaying this big sign in your front yard now? Like, you know, about 70, almost 80% of them said yes. So 90 times 80, this is about like 70%. So you just look at the change that has taken place. In the first instance, it was like, you know, 17% of the people who said yes. In the second instance, it is 70% of the people who have said yes. We call this the foot indoor technique. Okay, so this is in psychology, it's called the foot indoor technique. You can see why. You know, so essentially the first step is, the small request is to try to get your foot into the door. And then once you have your foot into the door, to push the door open is not that hard. You know, so it isn't that difficult for you to do. The question for us, you know, so conceptually, you want to look at it and say, why did this happen? Okay, so why did this actually happen? Because these are people who have roughly the same kind of like homes, you know, so the same beautiful homes, the same beautiful gardens. Why did one strategy result in people saying yes to a request and another strategy saying no to the request? Okay, so, and by the way, when we're talking about this, the way that we interpret it is that had we gone to the second set of people and done the first strategy, would have got the same kind of an effect. That's what, like, you know, we call random assignment and so on. So essentially what we're telling you here is the likelihood of someone saying yes to the request has gone up from 17% to 70%. That's the way we're going to interpret all of these different things that are out there. So the question I have for you is, why? Why did this happen? In the first instance, I got a commitment to them, you know, from them, based on a very tiny request, very small request. But the second time when it's there, they could not be inconsistent. They just couldn't be, because they had already said yes. And what is telling in that paper is, a lot of these people did not want to display these signs. They were quite unhappy that they had to display these signs. But what they reported back saying at that point is to say, I would have felt like a hypocrite. If I had said no, I would have felt like a hypocrite. You know, so that's the reason why I said yes in this instance. There are other ways in which we can think about this. Okay, so this, we're talking about an extreme kind of a case. I'm presenting an extreme case. But this is the way that even volunteering efforts, we think about volunteering efforts. You start small. You get people to commit and do a few things. Maybe they discover for themselves the joy of doing it a little bit more. And then they start committing a little bit more and a little bit more and so on. So the foot and door technique doesn't have to be that you start small and then you go immediately big. You start small and let people develop the commitment. Okay, let people develop the consistency. That's also something that is open to you. What I've shown you here is an extreme case, but you can think about it in less than that. Because consistency is a pretty strong motive for human beings. We do not want to appear inconsistent. We do not want to also be inconsistent, both internally as well as externally. And that is something that you can probably use in a lot of your negotiation situations. I'll take away for you one very simple takeaway. Okay, so I'm not even talking about the foot and door technique in the classic way that it has been laid out. I said the whole principle of, like, what is the principle? The principle is very simple. If you can get a commitment from somebody, people will do a lot, quite a lot, to be consistent to the commitment that they have made. You know, that's what the principle is. It really comes down to and saying, I need to figure out a way to get people into a set. If I'm thinking about, like, you know, the driving carefully, how do I get people to buy into the idea that publicizing driving and deaths and so on is a good idea? How do I get them committed to that idea? And then the actions will follow. All of their actions will follow. How do I get them towards that commitment is what it is that I need to be thinking about. The way that I would think in a negotiation, you know, in a lot of negotiations, and we think, so sometimes, and this is, you look at Brexit as an example, sometimes what people ask for and say, unless we resolve this really big issue, we are not willing to even sit down to talk about anything else, you know, so you understand. So there are times when people lay that out and say, these are preconditions. Unless we agree on X, Y, and Z, there's no point in us negotiating at all. Actually, there is. You know, there is a tremendous amount of point in negotiating about everything else, because what I consider now at this stage something that unless we have an agreement at that in on those issues, we are not going to have a deal. I might change my mind if we've made progress on lots of other issues, you know, because I now have moved from a situation of being like, you know, so just sitting and sitting on the outside. So I'm here now, I've developed some kind of commitment towards the negotiation process and towards the outcome itself. So you really, what I'm suggesting here is that the way we want to be thinking about the classic way that yes, there are some red lines that we cannot cross. We have to reach that deal. We know that. We keep it in the back of our mind. But why not try to make progress on a few other things? If we make progress here, there is a possibility that that red line will become a little less red, you know, so it will become, and we can say, maybe I can nudge there, I can move a little bit here. So that's the way that you want to be thinking about in this case. You know, that's one specific kind of an instantiation that I have of, like, you know, this principle of commitment. They're negotiating and they're negotiating in the public eye. So there are certain things that they need to say. There are certain... So as long as there is an understanding that what is happening in the public eye is not... And by the way, I just want to be clear. It's not as though, despite our many, many offers, David Davies, by the way, is an alumnus of the London Business School. I don't know whether you want to claim him or not, but he is an alumnus. So we have, like, you know, made repeated kind of, like, offers. Not to him, right? So it's not about strategy, but also because we have, like, a good program, we are willing to train a whole bunch of people, you know? So we are willing to do that. But there are, like, you know, they have their own kind of compulsions and so on. But so I'm not claiming I have inside knowledge of what is going on there. What I would hope is happening is that the public posturing is somewhat different from what is happening inside. I would hope. Okay, so that's where I will. I want to go to the second principle, okay? And this is this is a few years ago, probably now 4 years ago. I have a Marks and Spencer where I live, you know, so this a little store. They had this on offer, which most people, I'm very confident that no one ever picks up these, like, you know, little things that are there. But when I go to a store, these are the things that are most interesting to me. Okay, so not what they sell, it's the offers they have that are the most interesting thing. So I am in this unique position. So I have two daughters and my wife. They hate going shopping with me. You know? So this is the most interesting family dynamic. So we look at and we. So this is something that was that was there. So this is what the offer was. Okay. So the offer was a very simple offer. If you buy 6 greeting cards, the 7th one is free. Okay. So this is what is on offer. But we have given you the first 3 stamps anyway, whether you bought cards or not. In effect, the offer is, buy 3 greeting cards, get the 4th one free. That's what the offer is, really. You know, so they complicated it. And they've said, buy 6, get the 7th one free. But the first 3 stamps have been given to you anyway. So naturally, for someone like me, not you, I mean, you're not even going to see it. But for someone like me, I look at it and say, it's peculiar as an offer, right? Why are they doing this? They could have made it easier on everyone if they just said, buy 3, get the 4th one free. You know, that's what they should have done. Saving on printing costs, saving on the mental effort for some of them, right? You know, what is going on. Why are they doing this? Okay? So, in your mind, you know, so no matter how objective your mind is, and most of our minds are not, okay? So, no matter how objective it is, and we say, this is just buy 3, get the 4th one free, there is the small niggling thing that's going on in your head which is saying, I'm kind of halfway there, you know. If I don't buy these 3 cards, these first 3 stamps are wasted. Okay, so this is what is going on in my head. Okay, so I'm just thinking it's just going to go away. It's useless. It's just some random card. But that's what this is there. You know, so exactly that. I'm halfway there, and I'm going to add something else. And if I don't take the others, I'm losing my effort. Halfway, whatever that effort. So here is what that this offer results in more uptake of cards than buy 3 get the 4th one. Okay, so there is, and it's not in the context of Marks and Spencer cards, but it was like the car washes. People did this. They did it in the form of experiments. They did it in the, and there is also, like, you know, other kind of large data that that now supports the point of view that this is a better offer than buy get 3 get the 4th one. It really comes from this idea of loss aversion. Okay, so this is where and this is the reason. So this year's Nobel laureate Dick Taylor, and, like, you know, another terrific, you know, so if there is a book that you have to read, if you haven't read it, is this guy by the name Daniel Kahneman. His book is like, you know, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. Daniel Kahneman, I think, is the leading kind of social scientist of alive, you know, so phenomenal person, phenomenal book. But these are the ideas that they had, like, you know, talked about quite a lot. And loss aversion is a pretty powerful idea. Losses. So first, you know, it's very simple. Human beings hate losses more than they like gains. Okay, so this is a very this is a standard. This is something that we've now begun to know. The simple way of thinking about it is just mentally simulate a time that you've like gained something, and mentally simulated a time when you have lost the exact same. You know, so and think about it. The emotions that we feel, the disutility that we feel from the loss, is much larger from the corresponding gain. You know? So it's just that. So it's loss aversion. But what is profound about it is that these losses and these gains are something that very much depend upon what I consider to be the status quo. You know, so you can actually manipulate, you can do this, and you can create a sense of a loss or a gain by transferring, by creating what this is, you know, the exact kind of a status quo. What this is doing, so if you look at these loyalty cards, or you're thinking about, like, you know, these, you're just thinking about the cards that I just showed you now, these three cards and so on, it has created this sense of the status quo now is not zero, the status quo is three. And if I don't, like, actually fulfill a goal, I'm going to lose this three that I already have gained, you know. So that's what it's creating in your head, this perception of a loss, you know. So when you're saying I'm halfway there, it's not even halfway where, you know, that's not, no one is sitting on the thing, I'm halfway where. It's just like, no, I'm halfway, so I don't want to lose whatever I've done before. Okay, so that's where it is coming from, this sense of a loss. So just like I said, you know, think about in the first instance, I said, like, you know, when we're thinking about creating commitment to the process, the other thing that I also want is when you're constructing a negotiation, a bargaining mix, think about those issues that you can throw onto the table, you can give people on the other side. Something that has value to them. You know, I'm not saying something that has no value like those three stamps, but something that actually does have value for them. Give that. You know, it might sound somewhat counterintuitive, but by giving that, you're engaging two things. One is you're engaging this notion of reciprocity. So people want to say, okay, fine, I have to do something in return for this person because they have shown goodwill here and want to give me something. But the second is, it actually develops some kind of a commitment to the process itself. Now people are unlikely to walk away from the negotiation because they've got something. If they go somewhere else, they have to start from scratch. You know? So that's the way that they would be looking at it. Okay, one of the coolest findings in psychology, I love this, is that mere exposure to something repeatedly makes us like that something more. Okay, so some of these studies, you know, for example, you have like you have songs which are played at a frequency that is not like at your consciously. You're not consciously aware, but you can hear it. Okay, so it's at a level slightly below your level of your conscious recognition of it. You being exposed to it 3 or 4 times, and the next time it actually plays, you like it more. And so there are people who know this, right? So who say, oh, you know, the first time I hear a song, I don't like it as much. The fourth time, I kind of like it a little bit more. So it's people recognize that consciously, but even subconsciously it happens. My favorite study on this was done in Michigan by another one of my heroes. You know, so I have Kahneman is one of my heroes. There's another guy called, like, you know, Schwartz, who's also a hero, so not Schwartz. So for a period of 6 months, he commandeered their student newspaper, which used to come out like every week. And he took a little column on the right-hand side corner where he was printing a series of nonsense words. Okay, so it was just pure nonsense words. And he called them Turkish-sounding words. Okay, so I don't know why, but it's like Turkish-sounding nonsense. The words that were printed in these two different places, in Michigan State University and the University of Michigan, were very different words. And the editorial, you know, so the staff were supposed to, if people called up and said, what the hell is this? They were supposed to say, we don't really know, you know. So that's what was the response. But people were just being exposed to these words. At the end of this exposure, after 6 months, then they did a large-scale survey in both sides, and they just went and asked these people in Michigan State University and the University of Michigan, which words do you like more? Which is a bit absurd as a question, because they don't even know what these words mean, right? It's there. But they answered it. They're like sporting people, used to going to laboratory studies where people ask them absurd questions. So they went and they answered these questions. And what the words that were printed repeatedly in the Michigan University one, the University of Michigan students, they said, oh, that's fantastic. I like those words more than those other words. And vice versa, you know, so the people that were there. So now these are like stimuli that everyone knows is perfectly nonsensical. No one actually knows that where they have read them or seen them and so on. But the mere fact that they had seen them over a period of time made them just like it, okay? So a little bit more than these other words. So that, you know, so, but there are many, many such studies, okay? So it comes with music, it comes with words, it comes with names. That's like, you know, there is a lot of like this kind of like findings again and again. Where do we take it away, you know? So what is it that we do? So this is what, when you were asking about Brexit, what is the point of putting difficult issues onto the table? The first time I'm putting a difficult issue onto the table, which is a no-no for you, you might react quite violently to it. The fifth or the sixth time you hear it, you become much less defensive about that idea. So what I'm saying, combined with the first one that I'm putting out, is it's not a good idea for you not to at least raise these difficult issues. You want to put them on the table, you know, absolutely, and say, we don't need to talk about them now, but we need to reach an agreement on this. At some later point, we need to reach an agreement on this. So this is what we would think about doing. So oftentimes when we don't put, and this is not just in negotiations, this is also in meetings, you know, so quite a lot of times people say, I don't know whether the group is prepared to hear this. I'm not entirely confident that this, like, you know, committee will want to like have this piece of information. Well, it is better to do it early on rather than for it to come as a surprise later on. Because there are two reasons for this. One, as they become familiar, people become a little less defensive, a little more receptive to listening to it. But two, if you're the person introducing it, imagine, you know, the fifth time or the sixth time you yourself have thought about it, to you it seems like somewhat easy, somewhat less dangerous, somewhat like not a bad idea out there, and you're putting it there, but for the other person, they're hearing it for the first time, for them it's a terrible idea, you know, it's something that is really problematic. So what I'm suggesting here is just this, that it's a good idea to put difficult to resolve issues onto the table a few times during the course of a negotiation with the disclaimer that we don't need to agree on this now. You know, we don't need to. But we are going to come back to this because this is not something that we can just completely sweep under the carpet and completely ignore. It's, I can tell you, I've for the last 8 years or more, maybe roughly that, I've been on my school's management board and exec committee. And you can see this all the time. The first time you hear it and there's such violent reaction saying, how can you even think we would want to do it? The fourth time they're kind of, yeah, you know, it's not that. We should go ahead and do it. So Carlos, our head of exec education, he's here. In a meeting last week, I told Carlos, you know, so the idea that he proposed and I was vehemently opposed to it. And then now I kind of find kind of attracted to that idea. It's like, Carlos, this could just be the fact that you keep on repeating it. You come to my office, you come to a meeting, and then you keep repeating this. So I don't know whether it's that's going on, or whether the idea itself is like has more merit than I had originally anticipated. But you can see this quite a lot. You can see this kind of like reduced defensiveness when people. Okay. So and this is an experiment by and an idea from Daniel Kahneman's close associate Amos Tversky, who, had he been alive, he would also got a Nobel Prize. Okay, so this is, and when you read Kahneman's book, and those of you who've already read it, you see the first few chapters, he speaks extensively about his friend and his colleague and collaborator Amos Tversky. So Daniel Kahneman gives a lot of credit to Amos Tversky. There's another, like, you know, pretty powerful idea from there. So let's look at what this one is, you know, this particular idea. It's an experiment that happened in Stanford University, where if you participated in an experiment, you got some money. So people who participated in an experiment either offered like $6, which is the fee for participating in an experiment, or a very nice pen. You know, so that day there was a choice. You could take $6, you could take a pen. A lot of people ended up taking, in this case, they ended up taking the $6. This is a base rate. We're just setting up the base rate. So even though the cross spend was significantly more expensive, people had a preference for the $6. Another experiment, you know, so the same, sort of another condition. People are given a choice between $6 a cross pen and a not so nice pen. Simple notion here that is that when people are finding it difficult to compare, you give them something to compare. You know, you give them that something to compare. They will make that comparison. Everyone will tell you that this is a useless choice. It's a dominated choice. I don't care about it. You don't need to care about it, but you will still, at the end, you will have it. You know, it becomes a point of comparison for you. So what I'm suggesting again, okay, so the principle of decoys, what it suggests is that people find it oftentimes, people find it difficult to place a value in an absolute sense. They're able to place a value in a comparative sense. And you want to facilitate those comparisons in the way that you're constructing choices that you're presenting to people. So sometimes the 2% who are picking the decoy might be like 80% picking the decoy. So you need to be a little careful, okay? I'm not going to explain in full, but I think that the Labour Party with Jeremy Corbyn is a situation like that. Okay, so where a decoy has been picked and now the UK is struggling as a result. Okay, so I just think that sometimes you might have a decoy in your choice set, but the decoy gets picked and then you need to be a little careful about the decoy itself. I will explain later if people, I'm sure people got it, but if not, I'm quite happy. I used to be a Labour supporter, by the way. Okay. Just want to go to the next one. Okay, so as you can see, you know, I look like an Indian, I talk like an Indian, I'm Indian. Okay, so sorry, I want to clarify this matter. So I just want to say this because there is a certain side I come down on this particular dispute, okay? So this is a dispute about, like, so India, in not the last one, but the previous one in the climate talks, was marked out as a villain, okay? So and the way that it was put out is that all of these emission standards that different people were agreeing to in India, the Indian, like, negotiators were refusing to accept that. And if you go to India, okay, and which I go to quite often, or you read, like, you know, the news from India, there's always this underlying kind of the kind of, like, the theme that comes out is, it just is so bloody unfair, you know, the kind of, like, things that people use. So the West, for example, developed at a hugely rapid rate. They have a standard of living that is, like, you know, far, far, far higher than what it is that we have. And now they're trying to put brakes on the way that they're going to be developing. So they, when they ask for and they talk about, like, you know, the kind of the emissions that is there, so they say that the denominator that you use for these emissions cannot be a country, it could be the population, which then, when you look at it, because that's the one advantage we have in India, so we look at it and we use this as a denominator, we say we are actually the least polluting country in the world, you know, so it's per person is what is the right way of looking at it, okay, so that's what it is that's there in India. Naturally, we think that's fair. Okay, so this is all I want to put out to you. Now, you on the other side can look from the other side and say, what the hell? You know, what kind of an absurd argument is that? It's not our fault that we hurt so many people. Okay, so that's another way of looking at it. So so what the point is, this is very simple, is that we can always think about principles. We can always think about measures. We can always think about, like, you know, procedures. That will result in a different kind of an outcome if only we adopt these principles, if we only adopt these procedures, we only adopt these different measures that are out there. What we do know from psychology is something very simple, that human beings have this wonderful capacity to pick the principle that gives them the best outcome and call it fair. Okay, so this we are very good at. Okay, so this is, so you look at, we are very good at that. But if it stops at that, then it's not a problem. But the minute the word, and fairness has, like, you know, deep kind of, like, evolutionary characteristics associated with it, because we resist unfairness. The minute I perceive something as unfair, then I will go even against my interest in order to punish it, in order not to reach an agreement with you, so I'll, you know, so there are lots of, like, wonderful, wonderful things that people do as a result of that, right? So spiteful behavior is one of them. I'm not going to get it. I know you're going to give me 10, but I'd rather both of us have 0. You know, that kind of, like, behavior is there, is the result of, like, this cognition of fairness. The minute I feel and attach a label fairness to something, then immediately, like, all kinds of other problems come about. Emotions, my desire to punish you, my desire to, like, you know, ensure that you don't get anything at all of these things come to the fore. I'm not going to go into, like, you know, a very extended discussion of this, other than to note that a lot of agreements that can possibly happen When an independent third party observes the situation, they get derailed because the party is concerned. Each of them have stuck to certain ideas about what is fair, what is not fair, and then they refuse to make any kind of progress at all. Now, even if the negotiators themselves, they agree that we need to make some kind of progress that is there, but the constituencies that they're representing will say no. You know, we will call it betrayal. We will say that, you know, we would like, for example, we'd like to have a vote on this. And if the vote comes on this, then we are likely to say no, because we say no. I don't care that I'm going to get a bad outcome, but guess what? The others are going to get worse. You know, so this is where the whole kind of an idea will come about. What can we possibly do? You know, and for this idea, and I've been acknowledging where these ideas come from. So this is a very good friend of mine and a colleague who's written some wonderful books on negotiation. His name is Deepak Malhotra, who's at Harvard. So he, you know, comes up with this notion. He calls it strategic ambiguity. And I've taken this example from him. Okay, so he's the one who presents this example in his book, but also I've talked quite a lot to him. So this is in the context. About 10 years ago, we had a deal between India and the United States, which was a nuclear deal. So India is a declared nuclear power, but it is a nuclear power that is outside of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Non-Proliferation Treaty, at the time that it was signed, there were a few countries that had been declared nuclear powers that got together and they said, we will not allow this technology to proliferate. We don't want, like, you know, the whole world to have this, because it creates all kinds of dangerous situations in the world. So we don't want to have it. So what the people who currently have it, the way that I, as an Indian, interpret this, okay, so forgive me here. So I interpret it as that we have had it, we have it, we will continue to have it, we'll continue to do what we're going to be doing, but the others cannot have what we have. You know, it's the kind of way that we interpret it in countries that don't have it. Especially, like, you know, in countries like India and Pakistan, North Korea, Iran, and so on. Like, you know, so very, all the great countries of the world. So we look at this. So this did seem, so as a result of that, both India is struggling, you know, because we are not able to get technology. We are not able to get, like, clean technology for the development of power and so on. So we don't have that. So there was some kind of pressure in India to sign this deal. There was some kind of pressure from the United States also, because India has been, you know, and again, it's not just an egocentric perception. India has been quite responsible as a nuclear power. They haven't proliferated, not gone and distributed the technology in lots of different places. So they agreed to reach a deal. The deal itself, at the end of it, this is what the statements are by the two people who represent, you know, the two parties that are out there. So the big contentious issue was one of testing, right? So which is to say that we are going to go and have these explosions. We're going to be testing this nuclear power that is there. So see what Condoleezza Rice says, right? What she says is, let me assure you that an Indian test, as I have testified publicly, would result in more serious consequences. Existing US laws would require automatic cutoff of cooperation and automatic sanctions if India were to test. So there is a clear understanding that the deal is conditional on India giving up its right to test. Okay, so that's there. Her counterpart, Pranab Mukherjee from India, look at what he says. We would not like to convert our voluntary moratorium into a treaty-bound obligation. This position has been maintained. As far as the Indians are concerned, they have not given up the right to test. As far as the Americans are concerned, India has given up the right to test. Okay, so how can both be true? You know, so this is a deal that they have signed. How can both these positions be true? Internally, if you're looking at it, this is one of the clever ways in which negotiators will attempt to manage these, like, egocentric principles that are out there by creating sufficient ambiguity in the agreement that both parties can go back and declare to their constituencies that they are the winners. Okay, so this is what it allows them to do. So go back and say, we stood by our principle and we have won. By the way, we stood by our principle and we won. It might be incompatible, but hey, that's the way we've written this document, so that both of us can claim some kind of victory. There will be a problem in this case, okay? So we need to remember one thing, is that India is committed. They have made a voluntary kind of, like, you know, it's moratorium. Now the true test of the treaty will come if India suddenly decides to test. But the reason why they feel this is a good solution to this problem is there is no pressure, or there was no immediate pressure, and they did not anticipate any kind of like development into the future where they expected this particular thing to be tested. So let's write an ambiguous enough solution that's there. So go back one way. Egocentric principles are something, egocentric advocacy of principles is something that we know to be true. It prevents, like, you know, us from reaching agreements where we can. One way of dealing with that is to agree to a certain kind of strategic ambiguity in the way that our language is constructed for. So there is no agreement that's 100%, right? There's not. So we always have incomplete agreements. What we're saying is that, so as long as we know that this is so, if the Indian counterparty believed that this is a problem, we are going to test in the next year or 2 years, then it would have been a problem. If the understanding is, you know, we'll test for the next few 25 years, but we can't be seen to the outside world as listening to the Americans that we should not be testing, we will not test. So periodically in the United States, sports is big business, right? So you have the National Football League, you have the Major League Baseball, and so on. Periodically, there is the owners on one side, and so the team owners on one side, and the players' union on the other side. They have these collective bargaining agreements. So the NFL, last time their agreement is like a perfect example of strategic ambiguity, right? So what they did is that they broke the revenues down into three different things. And the union had always been advocating and talking about that always we have to have a 50-50 split, okay? The owners were always saying no, you know, because our money is at risk and so on, so we can't just agree to this one. So they broke it down into three different buckets, okay? So they broke it down into three different buckets. One of those buckets was like, you know, some kind of revenue that is attached to game day revenue, what we get. Another is like, you know, TV rights and so on. And the third is merchandising. And for each of them, they agree to a different kind of a split that is there. For the players, you know, so they get 55% of the revenues from like, you know, the game day revenues. They get like, you know, 50% from the TV and so on. And they get only 20% from the merchandising. So they write this. At the end also, they have the agreement that says, and if you accumulate this at the end, and if it falls such that, you know, so the owner, the players are getting more than 47% of what it is, it will be adjusted downwards to 47%, no matter what this thing is. And if it turns out that the owners are getting more than like 53%, it will be adjusted down to 53%. Why didn't they just come out and say, we're just going to put down all of these and agree to like a 53-47% split? They couldn't, because the union had committed to the players, we're going for 50-50. Okay, another example of strategic ambiguity. Okay, so both players can, there they can say, see, merchandising is not really under our control, so we can do whatever, but the playing is under our control and so on, and who we draw into the stadiums are under. It's different ways in which you create that ambiguity, allowing people to play. You know, so for them, a 50-50 principle was paramount, important. I'm going to stop. I'm not going to say the last of those ones. Okay, so I'll leave it at that. Cognitive dissonance. I'm just going to stop at this, just to summarize. Okay, so these ideas that I put on the table are psychological constructs that have a lot of literature associated with it. I've only given you for any one of them. I've given you one way in which you can think about using them. Okay, so that's all. I put that on the table. So what did we talk about, right? So we talked about the notion of commitment and consistency, and the idea that I put down there is to talk about how do you get people committed to the negotiation process. You know, how do you do that? What is it there? So we talked about easy kind of like, you know, decisions that people can make early in the process. We talked about this principle of loss aversion. Huge principle, you know, so lots and lots of like takeaways from there. All that I wanted to do is I highlighted to you how you can use this particular principle by giving something away for free early in a negotiation. Okay, so that's what we put down and we talked there. Mere exposure. I said it is important for you to talk about difficult issues with the caveat that you don't want to talk about it now, but it has to be agreed upon at some point in the future. But I just want to put it on the table so that you're aware that this is something that we will be coming back to later. We talked about decoys, which said in the construction of, like, you know, the different kind of options that you're presenting to people, enable them to make comparisons. Okay, so enable them to make comparisons within the choice set that you're giving to people itself. That's something that you want to. But the idea overall, when you think about decoys, is larger than that. It's not just in terms of what I give you in terms of the comparison setup. And the final one was egocentric. You know, so we tend to be First, we need to recognize the fact that just because I'm calling it fair, it doesn't make it so, okay? Because someone else can also have a different kind of a principle and they will be advocating that with equal vehemence, okay? So that's what it is. And what we, as like, you know, if you're part of the negotiation, what we need to do is to try to get past that, but at the same time, understand that others might not be able to get past that. So what can we possibly do? And I put down for you, thanks to what Deepak, you know, so what Deepak Malhotra talked about, this notion of strategic ambiguity. Okay. I'll stop here. And thank you very much.
This lecture is from LBS Live at London Business School. Find out more about LBS's short courses at london.edu/executive education. And for more fresh ideas from LBS's experts, visit london.edu/LBSR.